Topic 10, confronting workaholism. Recently, I was at a party with some friends, and there were people there whom I hadn't seen in a while. And it was interesting that, by way of reintroduction, we began cataloging for each other all of the things that kept us so busy since the last time we had seen each other. Almost as if we had to prove to one another that we were important, that our lives were important, that we could show something for having lived in the interim. By contrast, years ago, when I was the business manager for our retreat center in Pennsylvania, the secretary there was talking to me about the business of the priests and sisters who would come to the staff. And I, at that point, was commenting on how busy they seemed to be. And her response was, "Well, what else do they have?" She felt sorry for them and their religious lives, and that all they had was this business, as it were, or busyness of the running the retreat house. I think that all of us get trapped in busyness. And in the course of this talk, I'll try to identify what workaholism looks like, which, of course, is an extreme form of busyness. What are some symptoms of that imbalance that characterizes workaholism? Taking on too much responsibility, forgetting that if the Lord does not build the house, then in vain do the laborers labor. Overreacting to people's anger and negativity. All of us, of course, get confronted with criticism from one time or another. A disgruntled student, a parishioner, somebody at work, a family member. It's inevitable. But if we find ourselves overreacting, we are probably dealing with a situation of workaholism. We're working too hard. Neglecting physical exercise. Forgetting to laugh at ourselves and at others. One time there was an expert on wellness who gave a presentation, and she commented that it's healthy for us to have one good belly laugh each day. And that if we, at the end of the day, we kind of look back on our day and realize that we didn't have that one good belly laugh, that we should induce one. And of course, that generated curiosity. How to induce a belly laugh? She said, look in the mirror at the end of the day and look at your face and start by saying, ho, ho, ho. And then you will get yourself laughing before you know it. Try it and see if it works. Neglecting fascination time. People who are in industrial and organizational psychology note that for productivity's sake, it's very important for us to take periodic breaks in the workday so that we can look out the window, stare at a tree, a cloud, a bird, whatever it might be, to distract ourselves from the busyness, the work at hand, and that when we do that, not only is it good for our own souls, but we also are more creative and productive in what we do. Workaholism has been written about and researched over a number of years now. Everybody agrees that the bottom line definition is that it represents an excessive amount of time spent in work activities. Some disagree about whether it has to be accompanied by low enjoyment or high enjoyment, but some common characteristics are discretionary time spent in work activities while giving up important family, social, and recreational activities. Thinking about work even when I'm not at work. This is the obsessive quality of workaholism, these intrusive ideas and images and impulses, and working well beyond organizational or economic requirements. Now, before I proceed to say more about workaholism and then how to deal with it from a psychological and spiritual perspective, let's differentiate workaholism from commitment to an organization. Commitment represents an affective bond with the nature of the organization. I really believe in what I am doing and give myself wholeheartedly to the mission. Whereas workaholism is behavior regardless of feelings or values in the institution. There's not necessarily a congruence with the organization's goals or values. So it doesn't represent job commitment. Neither does workaholism represent job involvement, because it's job-specific and situationally determined. When we have a big task at hand, job involvement will mean putting in extra hours, going the extra mile for a period of time until that specific task is accomplished. Workaholism, on the other hand, is this consistent over-involvement, over-settings, over-times, over a period of my life. Now, there are three types of workaholics. The first type, which might be called the addictive type, the compulsive dependent type, are people who work longer than they originally intended. They recognize that work is excessive, but are unable to reduce or control it. And they continue to work despite social or health problems. Sounds very addictive. They experience unpleasant withdrawal symptoms or anxiety when they are away from work. A second type of workaholic, the perfectionist, which is similar to the obsessive-compulsive personality that I described in the last talk, has an unusually strong need to be in control, is inflexible and rigid at work, aggressive in quests for power and mastery, and preoccupied with details, rules, and lists. And thirdly, the achievement-oriented workaholic, what you might call the type A workaholic, who strives for achievement, is stimulated by competition, and able to delay gratification and focus on distant goals. Now, this sounds good in some way, except that workaholic, achievement-oriented people still spend discretionary time on work, are constantly thinking about work, and work beyond employer and economic requirements. What are the consequences of these types of workaholism? For the compulsive, dependent, addictive, as it were, workaholic, the consequences include anxiety, stress, low self-esteem, physical and psychological problems. They experience a lack of reasonable standards. They take risks. They lack creativity. I recall when I was writing my doctoral dissertation in psychology, I was engaged in a way that really preclude the enjoyment of learning. I just wanted to plow through it. I was in that job involvement mode. And it's important to distinguish between this mode that all of us get into, as I was mentioning in the context of job involvement, versus the stable trait that spreads into all areas of our life without boundaries. The consequences for the perfectionist workaholic are likewise stress and hostile interpersonal relationships. It's very difficult for coworkers to tolerate a perfectionist in the workplace. Low job satisfaction. It's very difficult to get the big picture when we're so focused on meeting the details, being excessively conscientious. And for the achievement-oriented workaholic, who may derive a great deal of pleasure from work, but only if they experience autonomy and a sense of achievement. If not, they're prone to high job dissatisfaction and frustration. Think of your ordinary day and opportunities for feelings of achievement. Imagine if your emotional well-being, your sense of self-confidence and self-esteem, were so dependent on feelings of job satisfaction. It would be fragile indeed. Additional effects of workaholics are on health problems, particularly coronary heart disease, secondary addictions like alcohol abuse and overeating, and the non-physical effects, feelings of failure in other dimensions of one's life. Intimacy problems, naturally speaking. How could a person engage in intimate relationships when your mind is always thinking about work and about things to be done, accomplishments, and all of the stresses that accompany those thoughts? A diminished sex drive. Constant interpersonal conflicts and burnout. Now, the consequences of workaholics are not only for the workaholic, him or herself, but also on the work environment, on others with whom he or she works. We can't forget that. Difficulties creating pleasant work environment. How can a workaholic who is so obsessed with achievement, with perfection, with getting things done right, be focused in any way on complementarity with the work and tasks of the others in that environment? They suck the spirit right out of a team, causing destructive competitiveness among coworkers. They hoard tasks and responsibilities to themselves. Workaholics tend to be hypercritical, and ultimately they work inefficiently. You know, the perfectionist or the micromanager is not really able to get the job done in a way that's productive and helpful and in the best interests of all parties involved. Now, there are effective strategies for dealing with workaholism. The problem, like with the other stable personality traits, is that workaholics are frequently resistant to insight and awareness. They are not the first ones to recommend themselves for treatment, for change. Because ever since childhood, all that they have gotten for their workaholism has been rewarded by their accomplishments, their achievements, their success. And the people who criticize are often discounted, discredited, not listened to. So that people proceed on their own track, on their own trajectory, without a lot of insight and without taking seriously the advice or the challenge of others around them. They're more likely to blame, in fact, other people for laziness or other negative attributes that they will place on them for raising the critique in the first place. So how does the workaholic change? How do we get the person to really set boundaries for himself or herself so that they can deal with this in a more effective way? Well, first of all, is to change the thought patterns that accompany work. To try to keep a record of the dysfunctional thoughts, the I shoulds, I have to, this has to be done before the end of the workday. I can't go home until X, Y, or Z is complete. It's impossible for me to break at this moment. You know, we talked earlier about catastrophic thinking. And frequently, the thoughts that accompany workaholism is that if I let the work down, I will be a failure. And of course, this is something in the context of unrelenting standards that the workaholic has learned early on, that if I'm not working, then I am not valuable. I am not lovable. That my desire for play or spontaneity or break time or for intimacy is always secondary at best to my need to perform and achieve, to these unrelenting, and the word is used advisedly, unrelenting standards. They never let up. They never permit a deviation, a break. Secondly, change involves examining the feelings that underlie this behavior of workaholism, the insecurity that exists, the fears of rejection, the sense of worthlessness and shame, which is at the core of all kinds of addictive thinking and behaving. Shame, that sense that's, you know, a fundamental sense that I am unworthy, that I am unlovable as I am. And so I've got to compensate for this by engaging in all kinds of behaviors. Frequently, in the context of life traps, the life trap of unrelenting standards is a compensation for earlier fears of abandonment or emotional deprivation or mistrust. If I feel that I am ultimately going to be abandoned or that people won't love me or nurture me as I am, then I may be motivated to work harder and harder to prove my sense of worth, to prove to other people that I am lovable as I am. And sometimes when a person is trying to recover from this kind of workaholism, they need to remind themselves that people do love me as I am. Or to even kind of use as a mantra to stop themselves in medias res, in the middle of the obsessive compulsive working, to use this: what am I proving and to whom? Am I still trying to win daddy's approval, affection, attention? Getting in touch with these feelings, and especially with the anger that accompanies these feelings. Because nobody works that hard without feelings of anger and resentment underlying it. All of us know, because we're oriented, we're built for Sabbath. We need time off. We need play time. And when we don't give that to ourselves, no matter what the conscious rationale may be, underneath that, we're going to be experiencing feelings of anger and resentment. So it's very important to be able to identify. Oftentimes, we can't do that on our own. In fact, I'd say most often, particularly since insight is so difficult to come by, we need trusted confidants, others who will pull us aside and say, I think you're working too hard, and these are the reasons why, and these are the alternatives. We need, of course, to identify, to investigate and identify alternatives to work. You know, some of us who are always working don't know what else to do with spare time. It's kind of similar to the other addictive behaviors. I remember when I was working with heroin addicts in recovery and trying to teach them what fun is. All that they ever knew that was fun was using the drug, going after it, finding it, using it. And so absent that drug, in this case, absent the work, what's fun? what does that mean? I even would say look in a dictionary and try to define what fun is and how to acquire, how to attain fun, and how to sustain pleasure in other arenas besides the work arena. To develop a hobby, you see, it's unlikely that a person who develops this workaholism ever had other hobbies because other non-work-related activities were not valued. Try to develop an interest. Sometimes people need to take an interest inventory just to identify what might be a potential interest of mine. And there are such inventories that are readily available online or in any counseling center, where you'll answer a number of questions, and then you get a feedback form that tells you these are the kinds of interests and hobbies that you may find interesting. And then to try that out, to take some risks to try that out. It's important, again, to set aside a certain amount of time to do nothing, to take that fascination time. In the context of the first talk on flourishing, I was talking about how creativity demands a certain openness and fascination time. As long as we're checking things off our schedule, getting one thing done after the next, we haven't provided any space for our minds and our imaginations to generate alternative options, seeing many ways to get the same thing accomplished. And that kind of expansive creativity depends upon this fascination break. Setting time aside to think about nothing but work. Now, this sounds a little paradoxical, but this is what I mean by this. If you happen to have the kind of workaholism where even when you are with family or friends or in some kind of recreational setting, a work idea or impulse comes to mind, what is often helpful is to have a plan, like telling yourself, I will deal with that thought, that impulse, that plan at another point, and give yourself a specific time. At 9 o'clock tonight, I'll give a half an hour to nothing but work. So that if you have a day off, you take the day and you give yourself an appointment to look, do the work, and then you really have to give yourself that half hour to do nothing but that work exercise. Because you have to be true to your promises or else it won't work for yourself. So that could be a very helpful strategy to put those intrusive thoughts away when they emerge in non-work situations. Sometimes we need professional intervention, especially in the context of group work, where we see effective models for how to work, where we watch other people and get reinforcement for working in a different way. The work system, and this goes, of course, beyond the individual, but the work system needs to be challenged. In an age where we are bombarded with demands on our time by every new piece of technology, which makes us yet more available, more hours of the day, and which demands reaction, response on our time. If someone sends you an email or a text message and you don't get back to them within the workday, they frequently interpret that as laziness or unprofessional or whatever other negative label they will put on that. We need to kind of challenge that environment to put some boundaries in place during the day. And then when I am not at work, not to discuss work with the family outside of certain times or when I'm eating dinner. Setting those boundaries for ourselves is very important for our own mental health, for the well-being of the people that we live with and love and care for the people that we work with, and sets up a place of freedom for us from the fears that so often mark and trap us in life.